I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast. Welcome to the Addiction Psychologist. On today's episode, we're going to be talking with Dr. Jen Reed. Dr. Reed is the professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at the University at Buffalo, and we're going to talk to her about some of her research in the area of alcohol-related sexual assault. Jen, welcome to the show. We're so excited to have you on. Huge fans. Thank you for giving us some of your time.
Thank you again for inviting me.
Okay, so the first part of our show, we always start off with asking our guests to tell us a little bit about their training history. We think it's important for people to know what kind of expert they're listening to, what kind of training they have, but also people just really love to hear where people come from. And so could you tell us a little bit about your training history?
Yes, I did my graduate work at the University of Rhode Island, and I went there originally because I was interested in health psychology. And they have they had then, and they still have now, very strong training in health psych. And then along the way, I did some practica that were substance use focused. And that was mostly just so I could get my foot in the door to do these health psych rotations. And I really wasn't thinking so much about doing any kinds of substance use research. But then over time, I was working with Bernie Slott, and then Mark Wood joined the faculty. And so he and I started doing some work together. And along the same time, I just became more and more interested in understanding the kinds of problems that people run into with regard to substance use. And so there was some synergy there, and I did more with Mark and got more and more interested in addictions research. And then when it came time to apply for internship, they had two tracks, or they had many tracks, but the two I was choosing between, they had a health promotion track and they had a substance use and misuse track. And I said, all right, that's it, I'm in. And so then I did my internship at Brown, at the Center for Addiction, Alcohol and Addiction Studies. And then I stayed there and did a postdoc. And then I came right directly from my postdoc here to the University of Buffalo, where I've been ever since.
Yeah, it's a funny story, is that it's like the 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon or whatever. It's like we can't have this show without somebody talking about Brown or one of like three other places.
And so everybody's related to these like four core pillars.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. And right, like I did my postdoc and internship at Brown. Sam mm-hmm. just started internship at Brown like legitimately days ago. And so there's also synergy here, right?
Yeah.
In the 7 degrees of Cass, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's all in the family, I guess. So, Dr. Reed, I've really loved your work as I've worked down there in Memphis with Jim Murphy, you know, doing college student work. I mean, you literally cannot do college student alcohol work without talking about your contributions and really just the amazing amount of literature that you've produced for that field. So I'm really excited to talk to you about that today, but we really want to, you know, focus in on a sort of specific part of that research. And that is on, you know, alcohol involved sexual assault, some of the factors that are sort of implicated, and on, you know, the work that you've done developing interventions for that. So we're really excited to hear about it. Could you tell us how you got into this line of research?
Yeah, it was not what I was intending to do. Much of my career wasn't what I was intending to do, but it's all worked out really well anyway. But I had been doing a lot of research on substance use in college, particularly drinking in college. And I also, I didn't mention, but I had been a research assistant at the Boston VA Medical Center before I went to graduate school, and I worked at the National Center for PTSD. And so I had this background in trauma and PTSD. And so along the way, I had been doing some research in the area of PTSD, trauma, while I was focused on college students. And so I came to be very interested in the whole idea of trauma and post-traumatic stress in college students and how that, you know, related to drinking. And so we had a study that was going on. We had several studies, but one in particular that involved us doing very comprehensive trauma and post-traumatic stress interviews with college students. And they weren't necessarily intended to be focused around sexual trauma specifically, but because it was a college population and one of the major types of trauma that you see in college students is sexual assault. So we were listening to women tell these stories about what in many cases were alcohol-related sexual assaults. And I became really fascinated by how incredibly complicated and nuanced the social context of these women were, and how women had come up with these different ways of navigating that and working together to protect themselves. And so I became very intrigued by that. And so I had been and still continue to do work in the area of just understanding heavy drinking in college students and other substance use. I continue with my line of research in trauma and PTSD. But this has been an area that I have really has really taken off for me, and I've found just incredibly interesting and really rewarding. And so that's how I got to be interested in this question.
Yeah, absolutely. Huge problem. And I'm wondering if you could even just start there. You know, what is the scope of this problem on college campuses and elsewhere, if you know that data?
The literature that I know the best is on college campuses. And, you know, the statistic that you hear most often is somewhere between 20 and 25% of women will experience an assault at some point while they're in college. So 1 in 4, 1 in 5. I saw a recent estimate that was higher than that. And, you know, like everything, that depends on how are you defining sexual assault. But if you think about, broadly speaking, some kind of unwanted sexual event, the numbers are at least 20 to 25% of women, which is really pretty high, disturbingly high. And then the other thing that you hear, and that is true, is that about half of those involve alcohol, and that has long been true and continues to be true. And the alcohol could involve alcohol on the part of the victim. It could be on the part of the perpetrator, and in many cases, both. And I guess maybe also I'll say here, relevant to the work that I've been doing most recently, is a lot of these assaults are occurring in a social context. A lot of times they're starting off at parties, in bars, while people are out together. And so there are other people in that context besides just the woman who's assaulted and the perpetrator. And so one of the things I've become interested in is these bystanders, or these people who are a part of that social context. And of course, in these settings, many of them are also drinking and using other drugs. And so that's something we've also been focused on.
Really, the scope of this problem sounds just massive, right? You're talking about like 1 in 4, 1 in 5 people, or 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 women on college campuses, which is, you know, millions of young people every year. And then alcohol is just woven into the fabric of college life, as evidenced by basically every movie you've ever seen about college, or all of us are on college campuses all the time. It's everywhere. Yeah. And so when those two things synergize, it sounds like it creates a really important set of circumstances that could potentially, you know, lead to some really bad outcomes. And so it sounded like in your interviews, you really started to hear some interesting social contextual factors that are kind of helping us to understand this. And so I was wondering if maybe you could talk to us a little bit about some of your work there. What are you finding in that space?
Well, one of the things that we had become really interested in as we were listening to these interviews with women was women telling these stories of sexual assault, but that were particularly complicated because often the perpetrator was known to the person who'd been assaulted. It may even have been a friend or a close friend. And so there's this level of betrayal. And then there are also some of the things that women were describing to us were, you know, what do you do in that moment, with somebody who maybe is a friend, maybe you like them, maybe they're socially important in some way. You perceive them to be an important person in your social circle. There's somebody you don't want to make angry. So like, these are the things that women were talking a lot about. Sometimes when we also heard women talking about seeing, being in a social context, and it's not just women, I should say, but we were in particular interviewing women as part of this study. But one of the things that women talked a lot about was seeing something that looked like maybe it wasn't all right, or maybe a friend was in trouble, or somebody in their social context was in trouble, being uncertain about, you know, how should I respond? Does this friend want me to do anything? So these are the things that I was like, all of this complexity in a context where people then may be drinking. And we know that there's a very large literature on how alcohol affects social information processing and decision-making and risk perception. So I was really interested in how are women navigating this? And so we, at the time, wrote a couple of grants. One of them was an etiological grant. I was involved in a project. I was a co-investigator on a project with Craig Colder, and he had been following a sample of adolescents starting when they were 11, and he had been following them for 10 years. And right as they were beginning to approach young adulthood, you know, it was around the time that I was thinking about some of these things. So we started putting some measures in to just get a little bit of a sense of, you know, these women and whether as they are emerging into young adulthood, are they encountering some of these contexts that we had been hearing about in my interviews? And so we had a little bit of preliminary data on that. So one of the projects that we wrote a grant for was to follow these same group of women who are now in young adulthood all the way through, you know, the next 5 years of their lives, from the time that they're 21 until they're 26. And to really drill down, and the study is a daily assessment. We're doing, it's a longitudinal burst design. So we're catching them 3 times a year on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and asking them very detailed questions about when you went out, who were you out with? You know, how do you think about this person? Is this person your friend or the people in the context that you were out with using substances? And then looking at, you know, how are women navigating these complicated social contexts? We're particularly interested in this idea of social goals or social goal orientation, which is how people are oriented along the agents, the domains of agency and communion. And these are two axes, and you can plot people according to this theory along these two agency and communion axes. And then thinking about how does somebody navigate agency being a sense of your own autonomy and wanting to be agentic in your decision-making, and communion, wanting to connect with people. And so social goals theory is really focused on how are people, how can people be understood in their social worlds according to those two polarities. And so we're interested in following women and saying, you know, do these things shift around when they're at a party? Are you more communal? Are you more likely to, if you're drinking, are you more likely to sort of be a little bit more communal in your, or are you able to maintain those agentic social goals? So it's kind of, we're really trying to drill down a lot at what's happening at that individual level across different contexts, across different days, and what are the factors that are going into the calculus for women about, you know, what are the risk decisions that they're making? How do they perceive risk? Are they engaging in, you know, efforts to protect themselves using things like what we're calling assault protective behaviors? Are they working with other people in their social environment to keep themselves safe or to try to keep themselves safe? So these are the things that we've been plotting. And one of the things that we have been finding that's really pretty interesting is that the social context matters a lot in terms of women's sexual assault risk and alcohol involved sexual assault risk. It is, you know, the case that alcohol and other substance use, and we just recently published a paper on co-use as a risk factor, and those things do confer risk, as we've known for a long time. But what is also really important is that what's going on in the social environment beyond just the woman's own substance use really makes a big difference. And of course, potential perpetrators, that also can make a big difference. Are they drinking? But also, you know, to what extent are women, you know, connected to other people? To what extent are other people keeping an eye out for them? Are they communicating, you know, what they're doing? To what extent are they perceiving that they're in a dangerous situation also seems to be pretty important. So we've been finding some really interesting things that I'm excited about in terms of moving the conversation away from just, you know, drinking's a risk factor. You don't want to drink so much. I can really put you at risk, because the situation is a lot more nuanced than that. And really trying to think about, it's not just about the drinking. It's about where you are. It's about how you're reading your social context. It's about how you're understanding risk within that environment. And we're just starting to unpack those data. That was a lot. That was one project. The other project that we're doing is an intervention study, which we've been developing. I'm also really excited about this. It's a motivational intervention that's being delivered to pairs of friends who socialize together. And so we bring two, and it's focused just on female friends. We bring women into the interview. And we talk with them about their socializing. We talk about, you know, where do you see risk or do you see risk? And thinking idiosyncratically about how can the two of you work together, given, you know, how you socialize and the particular strengths of your friendship, to, you know, to maybe develop plans for trying to keep one another a little bit safer, looking out for one another, you know, knowing if your friend might be running into some trouble and how can you help her, teaching them some skills around that, and really reinforcing what they already are doing, because women are already doing a lot of this naturalistically. So it's really just capitalizing on that.
That's really awesome. So it sounds like is some of the work that you're having, understanding the influences of these contextual factors, is kind of informing the intervention development?
Yes. So these two studies have, especially the ideological work we've been doing, has informed the intervention quite a bit. They were happening, they have been happening concurrently. And in the intervention development, we also had a phase one where we were doing a lot of focus group, just trying to listen to women and what they were saying about their social context. But there's a lot of synergy there between what we were hearing in these focus groups, what we were seeing in the data from the other project. And women are describing, one of the things that we hear a lot is how do you know when somebody might be in trouble? Being very attuned to who might be a potential perpetrator. And, you know, we all have biases about who might be a potential perpetrator. And we often, something we've come up against again and again in our research is this image of like the creepy guy. Mm. And everybody knows, you know, a sexual predator is a creepy guy, and he looks creepy and he's kind of ugly and he's usually old, which means over 30. And he's, you know, being inappropriate. And certainly there are creepy guys and some of them may perpetrate, but the fact is that, you know, perpetrators often are not an identifiable creepy guy. It may be a friend, it may be somebody that you trusted. It may be somebody who, you know, looks just fine according to your, you know, your ideas of what looks fine and what doesn't. And so a lot of what women are talking about are like, how do you know when somebody is making you feel uncomfortable? How do you know who might perpetrate? How do you know the context where somebody might perpetrate? Are there ways that you might be able to identify more or less dangerous situations? And this is something that, you know, our ideological work is showing women are actively thinking about and engaging in protective behaviors naturalistically to try to keep themselves a little bit safer. And so we've been trying to leverage that in the intervention and say, what do we know? What don't we know? What are some of the perceptions we may have about what's risky and what's not that actually turn out not to be so true? And really, again, just encouraging women to think about some of those things in their own lives in ways that make sense for them and that they can, you know, use when they're going out, especially in this intervention together.
Wow, that's really awesome. I was wondering if maybe you could walk us through some of the things that you do know about the risk factors and so forth that you're teaching people as part of the intervention.
Yeah. I mean, one of them is, you know, what I just alluded to, which is perpetrators don't look a particular way. Yeah. You know, and we don't want to send women off being suspicious of every friend they have, but also just to be mindful of the fact that you can't just look at somebody and know that they may be a perpetrator. And it's good to have, you know, safety plans in mind as you're going out that just are, you know, making sure that you and your friends, for example, are keeping an eye out, making sure that nothing's going on, but not just counting on the fact that you're going to be able to know a perpetrator, he looks a certain way, and, you know, and that's all you need to know. You know, I think other things, some of them do have to do with drinking. You know, heavy drinking, these are risk factors. And our intervention is purposefully not designed to reduce drinking. We recognize that it may reduce drinking, but there's been some research that suggests that just reducing drinking alone is not sufficient to reduce sexual assault risk. And so sometimes in the intervention, women will say, hey, you know what? I think like my drinking is making it harder for me to execute a plan. You know, if I decide, okay, this is what my friend and I are going to do to try to enhance one another's safety, you know, and if I drink a lot, I just lose track of that. So, and then if that's a goal that a woman identifies, we'll work with her around how to do that, but it is not our intention. And so this is different. This particular MI is different than some other MIs in that it's not a drinking reduction MI. But we will talk about, you know, are there ways that drinking could interfere with, you know, your own self-protection or your effort to help your friend protect herself? How can we work around that? What are some strategies you might use to minimize the impact that alcohol might have on what we sometimes think about as like bystander behaviors or helping one in their behaviors? You know, we also talk some about, you know, things that we know may put women at risk, getting drawn away from their group, from their friend group, you know, relying on somebody for a ride home, getting someplace where you don't know where you are, and therefore you can't call an Uber or taxi to come get you. And so you're really kind of stuck there. You know, seeing other people around you becoming highly intoxicated, something women have talked quite a bit about is, you know, being really aware of people who have a reputation, not necessarily for perpetration, but for like hostile attitudes toward women. That's something that women observe naturalistically. And that's also something that has been linked to assault perpetration. So it is really nice sometimes when you work in the field of substance use and misuse, there's like kind of what's happening in the world, and then there's what's happening in the literature, and they feel like two different things. And here it's been really nice to see how well a lot of what women are seeing in their lives. You know, you can back that up by saying, you know, yep, you're right. And there are data to show that. And so how can we take steps to help you protect yourself a little bit more, knowing what you're seeing and knowing that there are actually data to support what you're observing?
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, college populations are kind of ideally suited for a harm reduction approach. And I think that's kind of partially why harm reduction approaches have sort of taken root in these populations or amongst researchers who study college students, you know, because we know college students are going to drink. And there's a non-negligible percentage of the college population where that is a critical part of their social experience during college. I'm really interested in this approach, which is a harm reduction approach for alcohol-related harms, but that don't even really, you know, focus on alcohol at all. I think that's a really interesting and unique way to sort of acknowledge and yet still try and target the specific severe harm that can occur.
Yeah, and I think, you know, something that we worried about when we were thinking about this intervention, something I worry about now, even as I'm talking about this intervention, something that reviewers were very sensitive to, you know, the reviewers of the grant proposal and then, you know, reviewers of papers that we've been submitting is we do not want to come across as suggesting that by telling women, hey, there might be some things that you could do that would, you know, maximize your safety or make it more likely that you will feel safer and be safer. That in no way suggests that women are to blame for, you know, sexual assault.
That's a great point.
Their responsibility or their fault. But what is also fairly clear, at least at this stage, is that interventions that target potential perpetrators have not been incredibly successful. And that's not to say they never could be, or that maybe we just haven't found the right combination or, but I feel pretty strongly that in talking to women, and again, women are out there and they are doing these things already. Women are already in these social environments and thinking, you know, and they know, they may not know, oh, it's 1 in 4, it's 1 in 5, but they know that sexual assault and alcohol involved sexual assault on college campuses is a significant problem and something that they could affect them. So they're already thinking, how do I keep myself safe? So this intervention is really about like, hey, you know, maybe we can be helpful. We do know some things that may be helpful and working with them around that. And so far women have, in our interventions have responded really positively to that.
Yeah, this is a series of really great points, right? Like, one is the blame issue, which I think is pretty nuanced here, but also just like imperative for us to just speak openly about, like, you're not to blame. And these women are already doing these things. And so how can we help them do these kinds of things? And that perpetrator focused interventions have been not successful. I think Bill George would famously talk about some failed kind of recidivism relapse stuff with sex offenders that has not been successful. And so, you know, the way I've always kind of thought about it, as I've heard you talk about this before, is the idea of maybe like kind of just kind of reducing the risk profile of situations in ways that I can think of, about how to protect me and how to protect my friends in a way that allow us to engage and have a great time and also be mindful about these things that are happening in 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 people out there in our space.
Yeah. Yeah. And something that, because this was a concern of ours and because it was something that the reviewers had asked about, you know, we've measured it, and we have been really encouraged that, in general, the response is that this feels empowering and maybe validating, like, yep, you are out there, you are facing these risks. You are thinking about how to address them. You know, you're not wrong about any of that. And here are some steps that you might be able to take. While we someday would like to reduce perpetration, like that would be the long-term goal.
Oh, agreed. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And right. Like in the meantime, right. Like you're going out to these places and how can we help you do those kinds of things? Or how can we help you and your group? Yeah. Be in those spaces in ways that feel most comfortable, but also allow you to pay attention and things like that. So it sounds a little bit like, you know, paralleling some of the other harm reduction literature, as Sam kind of talked about, kind of protective behavioral strategies, right? Which are, you know, historically focused on use exclusively, but here are just kind of following in the similar kind of route, but kind of reducing an overall risk, some of which includes alcohol, if that makes sense for somebody, but also a host of other things. So that sounds like a really great approach. And obviously, I think just developmentally tailored to the population of college students that we work with, anybody who, as Sam has already talked about, and as you are, like a stone cold expert, and your contribution to college student drinking cannot be understated, or cannot be overstated, I should say, right? Like that, you know, these are decision-making points that they're engaging with all the time and are not interested in necessarily totally eliminating drinking from their lives. And so, you know, helping them harness their experience in a way that makes sense. I'm really interested to talk a little bit about maybe the didactic component to it and how, what unique kind of aspects, both from an intervention development and delivery, but also just from their experience, what that's been like.
Yeah. I mean, so it's a dyad based intervention, and it's a little bit unique. I think when I was working with, I should say, my co-principal investigator, Jen Livingston, when we were looking at the literature, there is a literature on significant other motivational interviewing. Mm-hmm. So where you draw a significant other in and you would do an intervention for both people, not exclusively, but a lot of that literature, there's an identified patient. You know, there's like the person who is trying to reduce their drinking, and then the significant other is supporting them around that. Again, you know, there are exceptions, but that was what a lot of the literature I was seeing was about. And this is different because there's not one person and the other person supporting them. It's two friends who go out together talking about the risks that they're encountering in their environment. And so what's been, so one of the things that we really are focused on is, you know, their relationship is what we are wanting to emphasize, and relationship and responsibility are two of the strongest predictors of who's going to intervene in bystander action, who's going to take action to try to protect someone. And so we're taking these two people who already have a sense of responsibility for one another and a relationship with one another, yeah, and we're just trying to like amplify that and capitalize on it and grow it. And help women think like, how can you leverage that? How can you use that? So a lot of the MI is around, you know, reflecting the strength of the relationship,
yeah,
you know, trying to draw out the strength of the relationship, getting the women to talk about that, like, wait, you know, what do they have together that they can use in their protection? And then, you know, or there's some pitfalls or when you go out, what, and it's always interesting, you know, one of the inclusion criteria is they have to be good friends. So they have to both report that they have a close relationship. So it's nice to see good friends, you know, saying like, oh, you know, you do this, or like they can
right.
point stuff out.
There's honesty.
Yeah. Yes. Being good friends.
Too much honesty sometimes from good friends, you know.
But I think that's really helpful. You know, I'm imagining you both have, you know, expertise in MI, and sometimes it's like, all right, how do I, you know, try to bring this person to some insight around this thing? How do I use MI to elicit maybe some perspective taking? And here in this situation, you have another person in the room who's kind of helping you. So that's been really great.
And who has that really, cause like, yeah, like in MI, a lot of times we're talking about a target behavior that the individual might be kind of defensive about. And and there may be things about this that people get defensive about, but by and large, you know, I think the participants in your study are probably willing to talk about and learn how to avoid that experience. But then you add on to that someone else who has that sort of in, like it's different to talk to a provider that you don't know very well about how you drink or how you interact with men at a party or something like that, you know, or the safety nets that you put into place versus your friend who is there and who can point it out and who can honestly say something to you. I think that's effective.
And that's been an enormous, I think, asset in these interviews. And I do I should call out Nadine Mastrolio, who is also a co-investigator, and she does some of our supervision. She and I do supervision. And one of the things that we really encouraged our providers to do is use the relationship. If you're not sure in a moment, or if you come up against something where, you know, the message seems not to be landing well, you know, turn it back to that friend pair and let them do that work with you. So that's, I think, just been a really great part of this MI. And, you know, then there's just like the walking through the social situations they go out in, thinking about where do you see risk in your own life, thinking, you know, idiosyncratically about, okay, so these are, you know, these are what you perceive to be some of the risk scenario. Let's maybe reflect some of that. If we see some things that we might want to share with you, ask if that's okay, you know, pretty standard MI stuff. We also have some skills and it's also interesting. So we have a list of skills that we give women or again, we're calling them these protective behaviors that they might engage in with their friends. And it's fairly long, but pretty consistently, one of the things that women will say is, well, you first handed me this list and said, you know, like, let's take a look at this and think if any of these are things you might be interested in working together on. Initially, women feel kind of overwhelmed by it because it's this big long list of all the things you can do. But then consistently they realize, oh, I'm actually already doing this and this and this. And so the conversation is about, wow, you guys are already doing a lot. Are there ways that you would like to strengthen what you're already doing? Would you like to add a couple things on there? Where do you see room for engaging in a few more of those? Or do you feel like you're good and we just need to talk about how do you maintain? So that's really the nitty gritty of the intervention.
I've got and maybe this is taking us off topic, but I've got a question about how often. So, you know, a lot of these women are already doing things to protect against sexual assault. And part of your intervention is sort of making the conversation between two friends very explicit, to the point where maybe they would be able to make a plan together. How often do you see that these are already explicit conversations happening between friends?
I, you know, the feedback that we have received both in our focus group work, but also in follow-ups when we come back to the women after they've done the intervention and we come back a couple of months later, one of the things that women repeatedly say is that these are things that they've talked about and they had some awareness of, but they really had not had explicit conversations where they made a plan. And that was what we had really wanted to do with this MI, was to take what we were pretty sure from the, you know, developmental work we were doing, that women were trying this and were doing this naturalistically, but that maybe we could be helpful by making that more concrete and saying, okay, so where does this leave you? And as you think about your social life and how you're going to go out together moving forward, what changes, if any, do you think you'd like to make, and how can we help you make those? And that piece is different. and we're hoping, we haven't analyzed all the follow-up data yet, but what we're hoping is that maybe that's a little bit more robust when women actually go out. And again, when you have alcohol on board, that process of sitting down ahead of time and having said, okay, here's what we're doing, here's our plan, here are our signals, here's how I can tell when you're uncomfortable, you know, here's how I'm going to let you know if I want you to come over and, you know, get me out of a situation, that you've made that explicit, we're hoping is going to be the secret sauce.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It kind of reminds me of, you know, like couples therapy, for instance, or like family involved therapy that I've done before, where like, we're talking around an issue a lot, right? Mm-hmm. But like, let's like bring it in. Let's talk explicitly about it and say like,
or this like is, in the third person, like, yeah. Oh, like this happens to people.
Yeah. You know? Right. Like, what do you want me to do if this happens?
Yeah.
Like, what are the words I can say?
Yeah.
Right. To like help me help you, kind of an option, which I think that a lot of those individual mechanisms are like more abstract and like, oh, I don't want to say the wrong thing, or I don't want to do the wrong thing and get perceived in a way that's not how I want to be perceived, or, you know, address you in a way that's not the way that you want. And that nuance gets kind of streamlined a bit and becomes a lot more concrete when you have these like really clear plans, which I think it sounds like the secret sauce to me. You know, I'd be curious to hear a little bit about, I know you haven't done all of the stuff, but do you have any preliminary stuff about efficacy or effectiveness at all?
We do. We have just completed, we completed recruitment, and we've done some analysis of our 1 month follow-up. We have, this is a really rough and dirty kind of look at this, because we have not analyzed the data in the way that they need to be, because the women are nested within their dyads. And so we have to really like attend to that. But our quick and dirty does show that women are reporting consistently decreases in barriers to intervening with their friend. And that relates to some of the things that you, Noah, were just making reference to, like, well, how do I know? Like, should I, you know, is my friend really into this? You know, one of the things that we know happens a lot in college drinking cultures is hooking up. Hooking up is also a risk factor for sexual assault. Does my friend want to hook up? Am I interfering with something that she's wanting to do? Is this, those are those self-doubts, that like that lack of communication, these are barriers. So women are reporting pretty consistently decreases in barriers, you know, changes, increases in readiness, feeling like they're more ready to go out there and engage in some of these behaviors. And at least some of our data, is suggesting that women are engaging in more protective behaviors, although, that's a little bit murkier because we've had two different findings in two different studies. We are feeling cautiously optimistic. We also, I don't want to make too much of this, but in our, waitlist control group, we saw that there were, over a span of a month, that group had 3 reports of sexual assault. Compared to the intervention group, which had none. Very small numbers, and sexual assault, thankfully, is a low base rate event over a month. But the data are looking encouraging, and we're going to do a deeper dive and keep our fingers crossed that that this is still is having the kinds of effects that we hope it is, and that the qualitative data, the women really like it. So it'd be really nice if the efficacy data backed us up on that as well.
Yeah. Well, it's really good. I guess it would be good pilot data for NIAAA, I guess, to give you more money to do it with a like much larger sample, because that's really promising. And you know, I feel like in a lot of our research, we expect small effects, but you know, hope this is definitely something that we would want, you know, a very large effect for. Hopefully that plays out over the course of, you know, over time and in future studies.
Agreed.
Well, Sam, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because we did actually use some of this preliminary data to write a proposal for a larger grant. And I don't want to get into all that, but one of the things I'm really excited about to do is something that is strangely, I have not seen in the significant other MI literature, is examination of interdependent effects. So these actor partner models, which I am not super well versed in, but it's an understanding the effects on the person with whom you intervened, and then the partner, and then like how much of those effects are dependent on one another, which is something I'd really like to do more of with this dyad-based MI. It really kind of gets at that dynamic aspect of when you bring two people in, how does that influence change? So that is a direction that I'd really like to take this work.
Yeah, well, we make this joke like every time someone joins our show, but we have no idea how many NIAAA people are listening, but if they are, you know, fund it.
Yeah, be on the lookout.
Wow, that sounds like such an important project.
Yeah. I would be on the lookout for this. Yeah. That's right. Out of the sea of applications.
Yeah.
Sounds like this one is really
only one application.
Yeah.
Oh man. We joke, of course.
Yes, of course. Of course. So I think that maybe leads us to maybe some of the last questions around this, which are, you know, what are just some of the stuff that really just needs to be done in this space still? You know, from our conversation so far, it sounds like a lot of stuff that you think might've been done hasn't actually been done. And there's still a lot of unanswered questions. And what do you think, you know, as a person who kind of has a lay of the land here, think needs to be done still in this space?
I think that's part of, I'm really excited about this work, in part because I feel like there are many different directions. One that I just mentioned about really trying to understand what's happening at the dyadic level. That is, you know, if change is happening, you know, how are those dyadic interactions affecting change? I also think that there's quite a bit of literature that that's on just bystander behavior, mm-hmm. Not bystander sexual assault, but that's shown differences that are based on race and ethnicity about who intervenes and who doesn't intervene. Mm. We would expect that our MI, because it's idiosyncratic and it's made for two friends in their social environment, that it would be generalizable, you know, across lots of different demographic characteristics, but we don't know that. Mm. So that seems like it would be another interesting thing to be looking at. And also, I have a graduate student, Aria Weisblatt, who's doing some work on understanding race-based and ethnicity-based differences in sexual assault risk in the social context, that these social contexts are not monolithic and that they vary quite a bit. And so, you know, I think there's probably some really interesting work to be done in understanding those risk factors. And then something else, two other things I'm really interested in, they're related. One is, what other populations are there? College seems like one natural population where you would be doing this kind of intervention, but who else might be a good candidate population? One that occurs to me, and one that we actually also have submitted a proposal to do, is the military, where you also have naturally co-occurring, you know, groups of people who are socializing. You have this real emphasis on, you know, responsibility to one another. That seems like it would be a really good fit for that. So I've been really, I'm excited about, collaborated with some people, including Lindsay Orchowski and Kristen Walterth Brown, and, at the San Diego Naval Health Research Center. And, so we put in a proposal to do that, which I'm really excited about. And then a question that I feel, is looming large, which is how, you know, if this works, as we hope it does, how can this and other individual-based interventions be scaled up? And I think that's another really big thing that is on my mind, is like, can you do this MI thing remotely? We've worked around with a little bit with that. Can you do it in a computerized format? Can you do it with a large group of people? I think these are the questions that you know, we need to be thinking about.
Yeah, that has been like, scalability has been like just ringing back and forth in my head, because this strikes me, you know, brief motivational interventions, I think, are great if you can get people to come. And most of the time, it's either mandated or we're paying our participants. And this is something that I think just has a natural appeal. People want this. And it's not a behavior that, you know, people are, you know, don't have the motivation, I guess, to change. So the scalability of this, I think it's off the charts, and I could see, like a large group intervention with dyads of friends sort of participating together. That seems like it would be really effective. Another great grant idea for in IAAA to find?
Should they be listening?
Well, I just related to that is also there's, I've been interested in, you know, how far out does this extend? You know, we would expect that these effects are not just specific to the dyad and that they extend to like maybe the dyad.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's some really cool stuff that could be done with like social network analysis about,
that would be so,
you know,
cool.
How far does this reverberate? These are just, I have no proposal for these, but these are, I think, like extensions of this work that could be really cool.
Yeah, agreed. I know Nancy Barnett and Michelle Haykalas and others at Brown have been thinking about this kind of like downstream effect of like people who are in your network, but not part of the intervention. And this one particularly, I can imagine, and this is obviously anecdotal, but like the idea of like going to this thing and doing this, and then like you go back to your friend group who like also drink with you, and but like probably not as frequently as this like true friend person, and be like, you should really know all of these things, right? And this like downstream effect. And then imagine if you scale it up to, you know, like incoming first year student kind of ubiquitous level intervention, and how that then has like reverberations down the line. You could have some serious impact here. And so I think those are questions that remain really important to answer, but have, I think, very clear potential, which is both exciting and terrifying, given the frequency of some of the negative stuff we're talking about here. So thank you so much for talking to us about this issue and about your work in this space. It's so exciting. And I just can't overstate how much of a fan of your work I am. And so this is a part of the show where we kind of pivot to what we call the take-home messages. So if it's all right with you, maybe we could pivot to that.
Yep.
So we usually start off our take-home messages by asking, you know, what do you think the take-home message is for people who are, you know, interested in making a change in their substance use as it relates to these issues?
Yeah. And, you know, as I was saying, like, this intervention, we are happy to work with you to, you know, set goals around changing your substance use if that's something you want. But we have had lots of women went through this intervention and said, I don't want to change a darn thing. And we're like, okay. So that's not a prerequisite, you know, in my mind. But, you know, like, but if people want to do that, thinking about can I do this for these people who are non-dependent, you know, heavy drinkers, but typically people who wouldn't necessarily need referrals for treatment. So the focus that we're working with them on is if you want to reduce your drinking, how can we do this in a way where you can still go out and enjoy yourself in an evening and do the things that you are liking to do in a way that is not as likely to bring you, you know, long-term consequences. And so it's very much a harm reduction focus.
What would your take-home message be for practitioners? And I would maybe even extend that to like universities.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting as we were talking. So we, as part of this R34 treatment development grant that we've been doing, we have been talking to stakeholders. And stakeholders, it's really interesting because they responded so well to the intervention, and they had two concerns. One was this concern about, well, we don't want to come across as you know, as blaming women. And I think one message is it's okay to have these conversations in appropriate ways that are very clear about not blaming women. But again, these are the things that women already are thinking about. And like so many things, I think in psychology, talking to people about them doesn't make them suddenly think them. It sometimes makes it okay to have those conversations and for them to think a little bit more clearly about, you know, what is or isn't true for them or how they do or don't feel. So I guess maybe to think about, you know, how can we change this conversation to think about this being an empowering conversation for women where we're talking to them about what are you doing? And how can we be helpful to you in the things that you're already doing, I think is an important piece of this. You know, the other thing is, everybody was like, oh, this is so great. I love it. The administrators we were talking to, and, they reliably said, well, you know, can you do this like in a webinar? No, the whole thing is like, it's about the relationship. relationship.
Yeah. Ask them if they listen to webinars. Exactly. Do they pay attention?
But I don't know. Webinars can be great and they can be really helpful, but there may be some things that require an actual conversation between people. And I think then the question there is to think about how can we scale those conversations to have maximum impact? But I think there's only so much we can expect of webinars.
Agreed. Yeah. So. If the COVID era has taught us anything, right? Like there are inherent limitations.
That webinars have limitations.
Yeah. There's some limitations to those things. What would your take home message be for policymakers?
This is something I'm still grappling with some about, you know, what are the implications here? But I do think maybe some of it is, maybe the challenge here is going to be thinking more realistically about what is happening on college campuses. How do we work with what's happening naturalistically to minimize harm? How can we have meaningful conversations about that? And that it needs to be, it cannot be prescriptive. And so that might mean that we need to figure out innovative ways to get in there and have the conversations. And I know, like what policy that is, I'm not sure, but I think these are highly nuanced, highly complicated situations. That's where I started. That's where it got me interested in this to begin with. And I think the solutions are going to be also maybe a little bit more nuanced and a little bit more complicated. And I think we have to roll up our sleeves and think that way in terms of policy and implementation.
Yeah, agreed. What would your take-home message be for underserved populations?
I think, you know, probably one that people who are underserved, unfortunately, are already pretty attuned to, which is a lot of what we know about what might work, we don't know that it works for everybody. And that work needs to be done. And so I think you would be right to be cautious about people telling you what you should do, because that research really hasn't been done on many, many, many different topics. I guess one is like thinking about, you know, navigating some of these already nuanced and complicated situations, you know, with a literature that may or may not always speak to your particular, you know, risk scenarios or your particular risk factors. And, you know, maybe attending to that, thinking about that as you make decisions. And I guess the message, and this is not an original message, but I think it's one that our field is coming to, albeit late, which is like, you know, we need to think about lots of people and whether what we're doing is, you know, what is our literature informing us about everybody, and are our interventions working for everybody? And if not, how should they be tailored? That's not for underserved populations. It's for everybody to be thinking about.
That makes sense. And I think that's a probably a good place for us to end, is that like these things are incredibly nuanced and we have to continue to think about how they kind of expand out. And I think our field in general needs to be able to think on a bigger scale and about broader swaths of the population in the US in ways that our work can really help them. And that's kind of been one of the major tragedies, I think, of addiction science more generally, historically, is, you know, systematic exclusion of specific groups that just haven't been included in the research, either through systematic oppression, through just lack of thoughtfulness or straight up discrimination or whatever it may be along the way. But I think is an important take-home message there at the end. So the last question that we ask all of our guests is, what advice do you have for trainees out there? So you've been like super successful in your career. And so we were just curious if you have any kind of nuggets of wisdom for trainees who might be listening.
Okay, so this is a podcast and you told me that I should vocalize nonverbals. And so I'm going to vocalize the like blushing that I am experiencing when you guys keep saying all these nice things. And the listeners at home should know. So thank you for saying so many kind things. I had two, and I'll try to just make them really quick. Sure. The first is, in your career, to be strategic, but not too strategic. That sometimes when people ask for career advice, they want to know like what's a strategy. And I think you should think strategically about what is a good move and what isn't a good move. But I also think A certain amount of success comes from, like, not to be corny, but like from just like going with your gut or going with your heart. I think that that's going to serve you well. And so again, like, strategy is good, but then there's a point where you should just go with what you find interesting, work with the people that you like, do the things that you enjoy. And I think that actually, it can't help but take you to good places. Okay. And so then here's my, this is a public service announcement, but it's so important in your career to give back, and to give back in lots of different ways. But that as you go through your career, you may not be realizing it, but you're drawing from this incredible resource, which is the addictions community. You're drawing from your participants. You are drawing from more senior people. You are drawing from reviewers. And so when you're asked to give back to the discipline in a variety of ways, whether it's doing a review or giving a talk to a lay community audience, or, you know, sharing what you know with, I don't know, your church or some organization that, you know, please, I would encourage you to give back. It's so important. And again, I do feel so blessed to be a part of the substance use research community. It is a fantastic community. Let's keep building it. Let's keep giving back. Do your service, do your part, and keep the field strong.
I love that. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I mean, the addiction science community is so strong and special. And it's been really special to me over the years. But we come into this field wanting to help people, and sometimes we can get caught up in trying to be, you know, achieve tenure or finish our PhD or whatever it is. That's still a part we can help others and help each other too. So yeah, thanks.
Agreed. All right. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure. And we know you're super busy, so thanks for carving a little time out for us and our listeners.
Thank you so much.
This was delightful. Thank you both again for inviting me.
Next time on the Addiction Psychologist podcast, we'll have Dr. Mark Prince joining us. Mark is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Colorado State University, and he'll be talking to us about his groundbreaking work on understanding the effect of protective behavioral strategies. Don't miss this episode.